This is track 2 of lecture 9 in the series Inflation and Price Controls.
Socialism has seemed to be inevitable because hardly anyone has ever seriously attempted to fight it. As I have said, everyone has been waiting for the businessmen to fight it. People have thought it was the businessmen's fight, not their own fight. On top of this, most people who profess to advocate capitalism take an attitude that reminds me of an aristocrat's attitude toward manual labor. They imply, at least, that it is something that ladies and gentlemen would not do. Why not? Because working with total commitment for a political ideology appears to them to be self-sacrificial. Such activity, they imply, is appropriate for communists and socialists, because the communists and socialists have nothing better to do with their lives. The advocates of capitalism, on the other hand, it is said, all have their own professions or careers to worry about and simply cannot take the time to work for capitalism. Of course, the communists and socialists have various professions and careers too. That does not seem to stop them from finding the time to work for their ideas. But then this is explained on the grounds that the communists and the socialists sacrifice their personal lives. The supporters of capitalism, on the other hand, being exponents of self-interest and the enjoyment of life, allegedly cannot spare the time and effort from their personal lives that would be required to fight for capitalism. Given these attitudes, it is no wonder that we are being destroyed and that everything seems hopeless. If the advocacy of capitalism is nobody's serious business, then obviously capitalism cannot be achieved, and the world must be given up to the communists and socialists. What is especially paradoxical is that many of the very people who allegedly can spare no time for capitalism because of their professions or careers now see the day coming when their professions or careers will be so completely controlled by the government that they will no longer find any pleasure in doing their chosen work. I know people in various occupations, and sometimes they tell me about the state of their profession and how much time it has left before they expect it to be destroyed by the government. What they tell me sounds like a report from a lookout on a sailing vessel citing some far-off tidal wave. 5 years left to go, I'm told by some. It's coming in about 2 years, others tell me. And sometimes people tell me that when socialism does destroy their profession, they'll leave it. Meanwhile, they go on doing their work without even a thought as to how they might change the course of events. They simply stand there like deer frozen in the path of an oncoming locomotive. They simply wait for socialism to come and destroy the major values of their lives. Now, the belief that working for capitalism would in any sense be self-sacrificial is absurd. It rests either on an incomplete comprehension of the value of capitalism or on an unexamined prejudice that capitalism somehow simply cannot be achieved and that working for it must therefore be a waste of time. But this kind of prejudice begs the whole question. Let us consider, therefore, how capitalism actually could be achieved, how each of us could make a serious beginning toward its achievement, and how we could do this not as any kind of duty work, but as a source of the most profound personal pleasure and enjoyment as we went along. The battle for capitalism is a battle of ideas, a philosophical battle. It is a fight for the kind of society that is necessary to man's survival. That is how each of us should see it. To fight in this battle, one must first of all be fully armed and thoroughly trained in the use of all available weapons. These arms and weapons are ideas. The most fundamental ideas, the indispensable foundation, are those which constitute the philosophy of objectivism. On the base of this foundation come the essential ideas of the great political economists. Political economy, I believe, should be understood as a detailed, systematic elaboration of the consequences of three great philosophical values acting together, namely the values of self-interest, reason, and individual rights. These values are at the base of all economic law, as I believe my previous lectures have shown. To acquire an understanding of political economy on the basis of an objectivist conception of these values is an overpowering intellectual experience. It is the shining of a clear and brilliant sunlight on a world that was before hidden in darkness and obscurity. And the world that is revealed in the sunlight is a world of harmony and concord. If this course has shown anything, it has shown the illuminating power of political economy based on such a foundation. And it has shown the nature of the harmonies that are to be illuminated. Now, this simple pleasure of merely being able to see is the first and most important step in the fight for capitalism. And the more one sees and the more enjoyment one derives, the better equipped one becomes to fight for capitalism. The essential requirements for obtaining this pleasure and for being ready to fight for capitalism are just three things: reading, studying, and thinking. Now, in my best judgment, what one should read and study are the books I have listed in the bibliography I have given you under the title A Capitalist Library. In that bibliography, I list many books that were written over a century ago. Some people may wonder what we in the 20th century could learn from such old authors. I will answer that question by saying that while Adam Smith, for example, was riding in a horse-drawn carriage, he was thinking the thoughts that made possible the automobile and the jet plane. Today's alleged thinkers, on the other hand, who ride in automobiles and fly in jet planes, are thinking the thoughts that will destroy all civilization. And as time goes on, more and more of them openly profess their hatred of civilization and modern technology. Please, therefore, do not make the terrible mistake of progress by association. Do not credit the achievements of 20th century technology to 20th century intellectuals whose philosophy despises it. And please do not deny the credit for 20th century technology to the 18th and 19th century intellectuals who made it possible and whose writings I recommend to you. I recommend these old authors because I believe that they are far more modern and more advanced than their successors, just as the old Romans were more modern and more advanced than their successors, the Visigoths and the Huns. The attitude that we must take toward these old authors is the attitude that the men of the Renaissance took toward the thinkers of the ancient world. Namely, that for us, they are a source of new knowledge, because what they taught has largely been forgotten. I have omitted from my list of books the works of three authors who many people regard as prominent advocates of capitalism, namely Murray Rothbard, Milton Friedman, and F.A. Hayek. I have done this because I do not consider them to be advocates of capitalism. Rothbard is an anarchist, and in his book, Toward a New Liberty, he praises Soviet Russia as a peace-loving nation. Milton Friedman is the father of the negative income tax idea and an opponent of the gold standard. F.A. Hayek is an advocate of a mixed economy that would include major features of the welfare state. It is true that individual pieces by these authors may sometimes be of value, but in my judgment, that is the exception rather than the rule. In particular, I would like to caution against the temptation to regard the writings of Rothbard as any kind of simplified shortcut to understanding von Mises. They are definitely not a shortcut. To use them that way achieves about the same results as if one tried to learn the German language by studying the Dutch language instead. One would see many words that looked very much alike, but one would never learn what one wanted to know. Moreover, von Mises is not such a difficult writer that one needs any kind of intermediary to interpret any of his books. And there is simply no substitute for reading him in the original. He is, as I say, the greatest economic advocate of capitalism. If one has trouble with a major treatise of his, such as Human Action, then, as I suggest in the bibliography, do not feel obliged to start on page one. Start wherever the subject looks most interesting. And if you still can't understand, then go on to other books on the list and return to the treatise a year or two later. Reading, studying, and thinking are, as I say, the first and most important step in the fight for capitalism. This work will be made much more interesting and purposeful, however, if, as soon as you get into it, you begin to try out whatever arguments you already have for capitalism on other people who do not share your views. Learn what their objections to capitalism are. The more serious their objections seem, the better it will be if you hold capitalism as a value. Because then you will have to learn how to answer their objections and how to answer their comebacks to your answers. You will hear all kinds of objections to capitalism. You will hear arguments that capitalism causes child labor, monopolies, depressions, wars, and every other evil known to man. If you value capitalism, you will see your value challenged, and you will have to learn how to defend it. Then, as I say, will give a sense of real purpose to your readings. You will be searching for the answers that will stop an individual enemy of capitalism then and there, and quite possibly begin to make him a friend of capitalism. In other words, you will be engaged in the battle right from the very beginning. Do not be discouraged if the first 10 or 20 or even 50 times that you attempt to argue for capitalism, you lose the argument. Your knowledge will be growing all the time if you continue to read and think. And within a year or 2 years, or perhaps a little longer, you will become more than a match for the great majority of people. You will have become a genuine thinker and a skilled dialectician. You will then begin to be of real value in the fight for capitalism. And as you go on and you continue to read and think, you will become a growing intellectual powerhouse. You will then be the kind of man or woman who can accomplish great things for capitalism. If you are a journalist or historian, for example, you will have the intellectual tools to explain the news and write history in ways that have never before been done. Consider the analysis of the oil crisis as just one instance. Most of economic history consists of a compilation of such fables as prevail about the oil crisis. If you are a lawyer, you will have the potential of rising to preeminence in your field because you will understand all social issues more profoundly than any of your colleagues. If you are a member of any professional organization, you will have the potential of obtaining a commanding voice in that organization. And it just may be that some of you from the most varied backgrounds could end up as being great political economists. Adam Smith's leading predecessor, Quesnay, began as a physician. Ricardo began as a securities broker, and von Mises took his degree in law. The major point I am making is that before we can fight for capitalism, we must raise at least the nucleus of an intellectual army that is trained and capable of fighting for capitalism, and which will eventually be capable of supplying officers and generals for dozens of future campaigns. Let us project what we could do if such an intellectual force came into being. Suppose that today there were 500 to 1,000 people around the country who had read, say, 3/4 of the first 60 books on my list, or substantial parts of them, and who had had a few years' serious experience in arguing and debating for capitalism. What could these people do if they began to think in terms of a long-term strategy for the victory of capitalism? I would like to offer these suggestions as a bare outline of the strategy such an intellectual force might follow. My purpose is simply to illustrate possibilities, to show what we might be capable of achieving if we seriously went to work, to show that things are not as black and as hopeless as they seem. I do not offer this as any kind of definitive plan, because I have not thought about it nearly enough, and because the field is totally unexplored territory. Nor do I offer it as any kind of exclusive route to capitalism. So please hold these considerations in mind. What I have to say is just the barest outline of what we might be able to do if we were prepared for action. The ultimate objective of this intellectual force would be the establishment of a capitalist society. But given the conditions we are in, its first major objective would have to be to make the socialization of the United States politically impossible. I believe that this first objective might be achievable in two basic steps. First, an all-out attack on the proposals to introduce government planning into the United States, such as the bill proposed by Senators Humphrey and Javits. For example, if we were ready to start now, then all across the country, a major effort could be launched against this bill. Everyone who could would go on the radio to speak against it. We would speak before any organizations willing to listen. We would write articles and letters attacking it. We might start a petition drive to have the bill withdrawn. Our effort would consist of an all-out attack against explicit socialism. Our objective would be not simply to get this particular bill withdrawn, but to create the most militantly anti-socialist atmosphere in this country that we were capable of. This would be the most logical starting point, I think, because explicit socialism is not very popular in the United States, even now. And on this issue, we would definitely have the sympathies of the majority of the people with us. We could build on their support. In the process of this campaign, we would repeatedly explain capitalism and answer all the objections that we would encounter against capitalism. Our campaign against socialism would largely consist of an educational effort in behalf of capitalism. This campaign, I believe, could definitely be successful. Let us consider what its effects would be. First, explicit socialism would run for cover. It would be years before people would run for office as socialists, before they would openly announce that they were socialists and the like. Second, every participant in our campaign would have become much more knowledgeable and articulate in the defense of capitalism. Third, by the presentation of our ideas to the general public, our ranks would be swelled by a large number of new adherents all across the country. These people would then become intellectually armed and equipped, many of them. We would soon be in the position, perhaps, where our movement could support some theoretical journals and perhaps a graduate institute or two. We would make further inroads into the universities and all the intellectual professions. Our next great campaign, leaping ahead, could then be against price controls. This campaign would build on our previous success. Not only would we have a larger and intellectually better equipped force to fight it with, but we would have the support of a previously established climate of militant anti-socialism. We could hammer away with the theme that we all agree by this time that socialism is wrong, and therefore we must oppose price controls because they necessitate socialism. And of course, we would hammer away at price controls themselves in every way possible. If we won that battle, we would have succeeded in making the socialization of the United States politically impossible. The result would be that the country would then be ready for a positive move toward capitalism. The country would be in a state of crisis in which movement toward socialism was denied, while with a still bigger, still better, and more experienced intellectual force, we would be doing everything possible to push toward capitalism. We would present at that point an extensive and integrated program of reforms explicitly aiming at capitalism, such as the establishment of a gold standard, repeal of pro-union and minimum wage laws, the phasing out of the welfare state, and the steady reduction of all income taxes until their total elimination was achieved, and so on. And then in the next campaign beyond that, or even as part of that one, we would demand the abolition of all regulatory agencies and the repeal of the antitrust laws. And ultimately, we would even reach the day of private roads and private fire departments and voluntary taxation. All of this, I am convinced, is perfectly achievable by men and women who would be intellectually prepared to achieve it, though it might take many years. Such a struggle would be the great adventure of our era. It would mean the rebirth of this country. Anyone who would join in this intellectual fight for capitalism would have the satisfaction of fighting for all of man's highest values by means of the fullest use of his mind. I do not know what greater challenge or what greater opportunity in life anyone could ask for. To borrow the spirit of a line from Ayn Rand, anyone who would fight for capitalism would live in it today. If these lectures have helped to recruit any of you into the cause of capitalism, or if they have enabled you to serve that cause better, then indeed I thank you, and I know that my teacher, von Mises, would thank you. Well, I have some very flattering written questions. May we look forward to another lecture series by you? Well, I have no immediate plans for such a series. First, I hope to turn this one into a book, but I wouldn't rule out the possibility, especially after your very encouraging reception. Is there any bookstore in or near New York City which would carry most of the books for one's capitalist library? I do not believe there is a bookstore. You would have to go to several sources. I think I list all of the sources, apart from mere publishers, of all of the books I recommend. One major source is Augustus M. Kelly, who publishes the reprints of economic classics. And he is, I believe, in Clifton, New Jersey. Unfortunately, I don't know the zip. But you can locate him easily. He's well known in the economics profession. Another major source is the Foundation for Economic Education, whose address I give. And now I understand that there will be a book service specializing in the back issues of the Ayn Rand letter, the Objectivist newsletter and so forth, and other publications of interest to Objectivists. That is the Palo Alto Book Service, located in Palo Alto, California. I give the address of that. Now, when you read these books, I hope that you will not be disappointed, especially when you read the classical economists, because, as I say, these authors are very mixed. They have many contradictions and confusions. So do not read them in the expectation that you will simply be getting lecture 10 of this course. They are the foundation, and the writings of von Mises, of course, who is a more consistent advocate of capitalism than they are the foundation on which I have built, but as I say, they are very mixed. So please be prepared for that. Could you summarize point 6 from the end of lecture 4? There is a tendency for prices of products to be governed by their costs of production. Well, instead of my summarizing it, you can find it in the recommended reading, for example, from chapter 4 of Ricardo on market price and natural price. You can get it where I got it. Please explain the principle of voluntary taxation that you mentioned. Well, the best reference for this is an essay by Miss Rand called Government Financing in a Free Society, which appears in her book of essays, The Virtue of Selfishness. And it is simply the realization of the fact that if we uphold individual rights and we deny that anyone should be forced to turn over any portion of his property against his will, that has to apply to taxation too. The government should not be able to initiate force against an individual in the matter of taxes. In this essay, Miss Rand upholds the principle that the government ultimately, as the last and final crowning step in achieving a capitalist economy, that taxation would be on a voluntary basis. And she suggests a concrete method, which is merely to illustrate why the principle is feasible. Her suggestion is that once government spending were reduced to proper levels, where the only functions of the government were the maintenance of the court system and a police force and a small army for national defense, the support of the government would then be a very small matter. It could be financed, perhaps, by a fee, she suggests, assessed on the value of contracts. If people made contracts and they wanted them to be legally binding, to have the benefit of court enforcement, they would pay this fee. If not, they would take their chances. There might be other ways of doing it too. But I should point out that if you look at the fraction of the government budget, which is really for the proper functions of the government, for example, the federal government is now spending about $400 billion. Of that $400 billion, much less than $5 billion, is for the support of the federal court system, the maintenance of the FBI, and the like. If we had and if you look at the state budgets and the city budgets, less than 10% of the state and local budgets go for police protection and the administration of justice. If we had a rational foreign policy, instead of building up our enemies, if we let them fall, then we would not have to have a very huge defense budget. And imagine if we had an entire government budget, federal, state, and local combined, on the order of 5 or 10% of the present budget, well then, voluntary taxation would be feasible. Are there any questions live from the floor? Mr. Samara? You ask, in a full gold standard, if you had a 100% gold reserve system, you are asking, as I understand it, how would banks have money to lend? Well, the 100% reserve principle would apply only against currency and checking deposits, not against savings deposits. See, the difference is with a checking deposit or currency, that is spendable as money. If you have a savings deposit, you cannot spend the savings deposit as such. You have to first go and withdraw it. So the banks could lend out the savings deposits. Or they could sell short-term bonds and lend that. I have a question. As a threat to the market economy today, which is more serious, overpowerful unionism or antitrust laws? Well, I could see a case being made for either side, and the problem is that each of them is capable of being extended. The problems created by each is capable of serving as a pretext for the government to go on to worse things. If you had asked me 5 or 10 years ago, my first reaction might have been, well, overpowerful unions. But I wouldn't be certain of that now, because the government looks like it is preparing to use the antitrust laws to actually go about breaking up major firms and perhaps to start nationalizing them. So that has powerful implications. Then the unions are inching forward and they are on the point where they may disrupt the functioning of everyone's life. So it's like asking me which is worse, bubonic plague or cancer. Mr. Schwartz? All right, have I defined economics? No, I have not in this course. All right, and what, do you want me to try to answer that question first? All right. Economics is something which is difficult to define, so I may not hold to the definition I am about to give forever. I would say economics is the science which studies the production and exchange of wealth from the standpoint of their integration into a system of production and exchange under the division of labor. Now, why do I advance that definition? Well, I don't think it would be correct to say simply that economics studies production. There are many other fields which do that. For example, all of engineering. The natural sciences could be said to study production too. Nor do I think that economics is the only subject that studies exchange. Accounting is a subject that studies exchange. Economics studies production and exchange from the standpoint of a special perspective, the perspective being the integration of production and exchange into a system under the division of labor. And for the time being, that is the best definition I can give of the subject. Yes? Wait, you say it has been reported that the United States is now fourth among industrial countries in per capita wealth, per capita income. What is the source of that statement?
I think it's
the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, my first reaction to that is that I do not believe that statistic, because the most recent figures that I have seen as of just a few years ago show the United States at least 50% higher than the nearest country in terms of per capita income. I think well, if you made a comparison on a pre-taxation basis, I suppose there would be some validity to it, but I am convinced that I cannot believe these statistics. They contradict my knowledge, which is that the United States is substantially ahead of any other country in per capita income. And if you can come up with some actual reference, I'd very much like to see it, because it contradicts everything that I know. For example, the standard of living in the United States may very possibly be double what it is in countries like France or Germany, certainly Britain. And if you drive through some of the European countries, not in the capital cities, which can be very modern, but like if you drive through the smaller towns and the smaller cities in France, most of them do not look physically different than they must have looked in the Middle Ages. You can barely drive a car through most of the streets. The buildings are terrible looking. The vastly greater wealth of this country would be found in a comparison of the smaller towns and cities. The environmentalists are opposed to nuclear power plants. One of their arguments, which impresses me, is that there is a large possibility of terrorist-instigated disasters over vast numbers of people. Would you please comment? Well, I don't believe that this is a serious argument that they raise. It's just something else. If it weren't terrorists, it would be that the fish are getting killed because the temperature is too high. Now, but you ask, what about, is there a serious possibility? What could terrorists do? Well, I subscribe to a newsletter which I recommend to you for what it is. It is called Access to Energy. It is published by a professor of electrical engineering at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He is the author of a book attacking the ecology movement. And according to him, you could have Ralph Nader and the various other consumer advocates and leading ecologists set loose in an atomic power plant with hacksaws and axes and whatnot, and they could do no serious damage that would threaten people's lives. So I would assume that atomic power plants could be made safe. Now, it's interesting why one would worry. You see, every time one thinks of the term atomic, one is automatically thinking of Hiroshima or Nagasaki. I doubt if that is valid. Not everything that is atomic has the potential to be an atomic bomb. I would worry, if you're worried about terrorists, terrorists could take over the traditional type power plants. Why shouldn't we stop building dams? Because terrorists could dynamite every dam. That would stop us from building dams. Why don't we stop flying planes? Because terrorists could put dynamite aboard aircraft. The freight that goes on is not examined. They could fire mortars from the edge of the field. If you start to worry about the terrorists, then we won't do anything. So that would be my comment on that issue. Now, I'd say further, I had no way to work this into the lecture, but if we were ever going to have a serious pro-capitalist movement, one of the first orders of business would have to be to take on the ecology movement, because the ecology movement is striking at the very base of capitalism, at the value of progress. And what would be required to deal with the ecology movement would be a heavy involvement in philosophy, in scientific epistemology. And I will toss this out to you as a thought that occurs to me. If I were to make it my major business to deal with the ecologists, I regard that whole movement as being virtually on the level of superstition. People are worried, in effect, is the devil, cancer, in the birth control pill, or is he hiding in cyclamates, or is he now in saccharin, or in what have you? Should we give up bleached flour or stop eating sugar? Now, what I would want to read, for the same reasons that I was originally led to go back and read the classical economists, ideas of this type flourished in an earlier era. And they were put down by someone somewhere or some people. So I would want to go back and find out who the writers were, whether they were philosophers or scientists, who debunked all of the superstitions that used to dominate people's lives. I don't know just when these writers must have lived, maybe the 17th century, the 16th century. I would want to arm myself in their arguments against superstition, and that would be a good thing to look into for starting a campaign against the ecologists. Part of that campaign, if we had people intellectually committed to capitalism, we have, I know in this audience, there are at least 5 lawyers or people who are about to be lawyers. Why couldn't we have our lawyers bringing a class action against the Sierra Club? The plaintiff being the human race. I would really, that is one of my fantasies. I'd love to see them try that one on. Yes, sir?
There's a recent article in Barron's by Robert Heston criticizing Nader's recent study in which Nader advocates that big corporations be licensed by the federal government. Are you familiar with the subject of that?
Well, I have a copy of the article, but I haven't had a chance to read it. This is the article, you say, by Dr. Hessen attacking Nader's proposals on the federal incorporation of businesses. I'm sure from all reports it's a very good article, and I look forward to reading it. I have a question. Why is socialism necessarily characterized by chronic shortages, or is it? Why can't they change prices or charge prices which equate demand and supply? Well, I went into this issue in Lecture 8. I'll try to recall some of the leading points. There are several reasons why a socialist government could not adjust prices to balance demand and supply. One is the simple moral and political pressures of a socialist society. It's a moral premise of socialists that everything should be free or as cheap as possible. The political pressures of socialism are overwhelmingly in favor of artificially low prices. All you have to do is ask yourself, why don't the politicians that we already have adjust rents in New York to eliminate the shortages? Why didn't they adjust the gasoline prices to eliminate the shortages? There are overwhelming political pressures against it. Even in the face of the fact that in our economy, there are private landlords and private oil companies who had a powerful interest in setting the right price. In socialism, no government official anywhere has an economic self-interest in setting a high enough price. In addition, it is not enough to simply set a price high enough in a given local isolated market. If you are going to have a price system functioning properly, you would have to have socialist officials who would speculate, who would anticipate shortages, let us say, or scarcities, and who would stock up. Now, are the socialists going to advocate that the socialist officials engage in speculation? You would have to have people able to buy in one market and sell in another market to have an effective price system. You'd have to have the freedom of investment in the different industries, the ability to produce different products from the same factors of production on the basis of a consideration of profit. Well, if the socialists were logical, they would have to argue that socialist officials be given the discretion to do all of these things, to set prices high enough, to speculate, to buy in different markets, invest in different industries. But then we're back to the problem that the one indispensable, irreducible power that a socialist state retains is the ability to throw out the present officials and substitute new officials, to say, all right, you people are running this or that industry long enough, out you go now, the property you've been running passes to someone else. Well, would you in fact have an economy based on profit and loss if those who were given the discretion realized that at any time they could be booted out and replaced by another set of officials? Simply concretize the idea: the real estate of Manhattan next year can be turned over to an entirely different set of operators. General Motors can be given away to anybody else. The farmers of New Jersey can be turned out. Now imagine, what kind of price system is that? Well, that's the price system that, as I said last time, would require that the capitalists be the saints of altruism dressed up in the guise of hard-nosed capitalists who would work selflessly for the benefit of their expropriators. Can't be. Yes, sir? You're asking, you say in the lecture I mentioned that under price and wage controls we could have forced labor. And you ask, do I think that they could put such a concept over in the United States? Would such a thing be enforceable? Well, I would think either it would be enforceable or the country would simply be totally disintegrating, one way or the other. Because if you realize what is involved in a labor shortage and in universal shortages, if you have universal shortages, and it doesn't pay people to earn money, if they don't care about keeping their jobs, then they quit their jobs or they work less and less well. They don't seek advancement. At the same time, each industry is capable of absorbing labor at the expense of other more important industries. The country would be in a state of utter chaos. The government in that condition would definitely try to enforce forced labor. And if people thought, well, this is a national emergency, everyone has to serve, they could get away with it. As I mentioned, they did in Britain, Australia, and Canada. Of course, that was in wartime, but Australia and Canada were not physically endangered by the war. It was simply a labor shortage. So I would think if we had a labor shortage, the alternative is collapse of the economy if they don't give up the controls. Given today's views, with people thinking that if there's a national emergency, the government has the right to order you to do anything, already there are proposals to force the graduates of medical schools into a draft after they graduate to serve in different areas of the country. Well, this would simply be an extension of that kind of thinking. I see a question. I read in a Harry Brown book that all historical inflations have ultimately turned into runaway inflations. Is this true? If so, does this not mean that the fight for capitalism will be more difficult, say, than the socialist fight against it? Well, there are certainly powerful built-in tendencies that make an inflation either accelerate or precipitate a crisis. I would not say that it is true that every inflation has resulted in a runaway inflation. Some inflations have been stopped before they got that far. What may be correct is that if an inflation goes on and once reaches a certain size, where if it gets very large, then it's more and more likely that it will become a total inflation. Now, what is the effect of this concerning the fight for capitalism and against socialism? Well, I don't think it has to have any definite effect one way or the other. It depends on what the thinking of people is. If people were to be convinced that the cause of the inflation is the policies of the government, that the government is driven to create more money because of the welfare state, because of the desire of the government to have more and more programs, because of false ideas about unemployment, because of the problems created by labor unions. In other words, if people were to correctly identify all of the causes that would lead the government to inflate, and then they began to suffer from the inflation, their natural reaction would not be more government control, more socialism, it would be less. See, the way people act depends on their view of what they think will solve their problems. It does not depend on the problems themselves. You can have the identical problem producing opposite responses if people have different ideas about how to solve the problem. If people think that the inflation is caused by the greed of the capitalists, then if they suffer from inflation, they'll demand socialism. But if, as I say, they believe it's caused by the socialist policies that already exist, then they will demand capitalism. A further example of this same point, people very often say the people in the backward countries are in favor of communism because they're poor. That isn't true. The people in the backward countries are in favor of communism not because they're poor, but because they believe that communism is the best way to deal with their poverty. If they had different ideas, if they thought they are poor and communism will keep them poor or make them poorer, kill them and make them live in a life of terror, then they would be fighting revolutions in favor of capitalism. See, with a change in ideology, instead of Moscow and Peking being the center of world revolution, Washington would be the center of world revolution, as it was in the late 18th and early 19th century. Now, there is one point that I had hoped that someone would ask me a question on. It's not a major philosophical issue, but it's an interesting matter, and I think an important one, which is in reference to the reporting on the conditions in Russia. I noticed when I pointed out that two excellent books had, or two very good books at any rate, had appeared dealing with conditions in Russia, and that they were written by correspondents of leading newspapers. Many people were surprised, and my own first reaction was surprise. Because if you read the newspapers, you get a very different impression. So let me say first a word about how to read the articles on Soviet Russia. I think you have to read them with the assumption that they are being written under some form of censorship. And if I can find the second half, I would like to... Yes, I have it. I would like to take an article which appeared in the New York Times on January 14th of this year, which is a typical kind of article dealing with Soviet Russia. But I would suggest when you read the articles on Russia, make a little mark against all of the sentences that seem bizarre if considered in their own right. Note all of the strange, peculiar little patches, the isolated sentences, and then go back and reread the article reading those sentences. And let me do that with an article describing a train ride across Siberia. If you read the article as a whole, you'd have no understanding of it. You'd think, well, something is going on there, it's okay, they're civilized. A peasant woman burdened by an old-fashioned yoke with two heavy pails dangling from it plods down a chill country road near the tracks. On the second day out, this is a scene from the window of the train as it passes through the countryside. On the second day out from Moscow and just into Asia, after the gentle crossing of the Urals, some male passengers change into something like gym clothes. Heavy blue pullover jersey and long sweatpants to save wear and tear on everyday suits. One of them, a burly wrestler with a penchant for vodka and loud singing in his compartment, appears in the corridor bare-chested, despite interior temperatures ranging from 52 at night to 62 in the afternoon, indicating it's rather cold in that train. A small young woman conductor is kept busy shoveling coal into a furnace at the end of the car to provide heat. At stations, buckets of coal are distributed to each car. In the two-berth soft compartments, life is comfortable except for the unaccustomed nip in the air. At Tayumen, a young teacher boards the train, and learning that an American is in her car, she eagerly seeks him out. In excellent British-accented English, she asks whether he has anything he can lend her to read. She gratefully accepts a thick copy of The New Yorker, scans the pages of color advertisements carefully, and says, "I'll read it scrupulously for a couple of years." Her dream, she says wistfully, is to be able to visit London someday. At Novosibirsk, Siberia's biggest city, with more than 1 million residents, the train rumbles across the awesome Ob River. The view of the downtown streets with their big public buildings and massive block-long apartments quickly gives way to narrow alleys of timbered houses in the outskirts. These houses appear no different from the log structures in the small villages. So they're living in log cabins in their cities. Now, if I were a journalist, I would find it very interesting why reporters have suddenly been able to write books, why they hadn't in the past. And I would be very interested in an article that appeared in the Times on February 11th, which indicates that the United States government has been pursuing a policy of censorship in favor of Soviet Russia. How incredible as this sounds, let me just quote a few paragraphs from this article. It is entitled, "Book Screening by U.S. is Ended. Manuscript on Soviet Tour was Focus of Protest." And it begins, "The State Department has withdrawn a requirement that members of cultural exchange tours it sponsors submit any writings for clearance, and now says that, quote, changing concerns and sensibilities make the requirement a historic anomaly." They say the department acted after a protest by the American Civil Liberties Union, whose legal director, Melvin L. Wolf, had charged it with censorship in violation of the First Amendment guarantee of free speech. The book, someone had made a tour of Russia, evidently a rock and roll musician. He had written a book that was fairly critical of Russia. He was told he had to clear it with the State Department, and they refused to give him permission on the grounds that he had gone on a tour and had waived his right of free speech. Now, this indicates that the government has been pursuing a policy of censorship in that area. I know of at least one instance in the past when a television program was scheduled to be put on by CBS depicting Khrushchev's takeover, that the government tried to put pressure on CBS not to show it. So I would assume that there is a regular, consistent government policy of censorship carried out for the purpose of promoting, quote, détente. Now, I think nothing could be more valuable than an investigation of the government's censorship in favor of socialism. If someone were a reporter and uncovered such a story, I would think that would certainly do very well for him personally, and it would also be something that could help the overall state of affairs. Mr. Dietz? You're asking, in effect, are there any arguments against corporations dealing with Soviet Russia? Is there an economic justification of people dealing with Soviet Russia? Only if the Russians paid cash on the barrel. If they paid gold. But as I've pointed out in other lectures, the Russians do not very often buy things for cash. They buy them on credit, which they do not repay. And I saw a headline in this last Sunday's Times that the Russians evidently are now borrowed pretty much up to the hilt at the Western banks, not just in the United States, but throughout Western Europe. And I would not be surprised if they simply announced that they were going to renege on their loans. What makes this possible is the government gives guarantees of loans to the Russians. If they expropriated the foreign loans once or twice, that would be enough to stop any further transactions with them on a credit basis for the next 25 or 50 years. The Russians would have a lower credit rating than New York City. I see that we're beginning to run out of time. This will be the last question, Mr. Mangiero. Could I recommend a good book or source that discusses the economic history of the Depression in detail? Well, there's no book that I can recommend as being really good. One book that I could recommend that you read is called Economics and the Public Welfare by Benjamin M. Anderson. It's reviewed by von Mises in Planning for Freedom, I think under the article Benjamin M. Anderson Challenges the Philosophy of the Pseudo-Progressives. That is an economic history of the years from 1914 up through the Depression. I think that about does it. Thank you again.